Hello.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Get Deep and Keep It Real with Tiffany Camilla. How are you today? Well, thank you for joining my show. I have a very special show for you lined up today. I do apologize if I sound under the weather, but hey, we had to do what we do in New Orleans, and I was celebrating Mardi Gras yesterday. So a lot of rain, a lot of cold, and so now I'm just trying to keep it together. So just bear with me today. And without further ado, I would like to bring on my guest for today. His name is Rudy Richardson, and he's going to be sharing his story of survival and transformation. I like to title the show Resurrection of a Soldier because this is exactly what has happened to Mr. Richardson. So here we are on Get Deep and Keep It Real with Rudy Richardson. Hello,
Hello, how are you?
I'm great.
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm a little under the weather, but feeling a little bit better now.
Oh, that's good. Well, you sound good from here.
Great. Lots of tea. Lots of tea and honey today.
Okay, good stuff.
So how are things in London?
Well, things are going they're going pretty good here. I'm doing the final edit of my book titled The World According to My Gospel. And,
yes.
You know, it's like, you know, whenever you do that last edit, there's always so many other things that you want to add, you know, into the book. And it just brings up a lot of different feelings. You know, it's like a roller coaster ride, you know. But,
definitely.
Yeah, so that's where I'm at. Yeah.
Well, why don't you share with my listeners a little bit of how you came to write the book? And
absolutely,
without
sure.
giving too much away, I guess, about your book, but kind of tell us a
right.
little tidbit here.
Yes, well, I'll tell you, yeah. There, back in the 50s, between the years of 1945, all the way up until the mid-60s, there were black children, black German children, and our fathers were the very servicemen that were stationed over in Germany. So at the
mm-hmm.
time during the 50s, you know, the German, you know, they still had that attitude, like, you know, that superiority attitude. And mm-hmm. they had already lost the war. And, you know, they still had their own racial views of the world and things like that. And so when they saw, you know, mixed race children being born, that was like the ultimate, you know, like, oh, my God, you know, what's next? And so what they did is, you know, they started pressuring our moms to give us away. You know, at first they took us to children's homes, and I believe the Catholic Church picked us up. And to make a long story short, there is a magazine called Ebony Magazine and Jet. And back mm-hmm. during the 50s, they heard about the plight of, we were called brown babies, meaning mm-hmm. where we were at, where the government was taking us, you know, we weren't treated good. You know what I mean? There
right.
was a lot of abuse going on. So anyway, I was adopted by American parents. And,
okay.
You know, and that was a lifesaver. They adopted a baby girl a year before me, my sister Pamela. And, you know, that was, you know, if I look in hindsight, you know,
right.
I was really, really grateful and blessed, you know, to be adopted and to be pulled from that
right.
environment that I was in. So anyway, you know, we go back to the States, yada, yada. I'm around 13 years old, and my mom, she becomes addicted to taking these, barbiturates, sleeping pills at first,
mm-hmm.
like Valiums, and then it graduated on, and she just got to a point where she began to deteriorate in front of, you know, the family's eyes. And this was like in the 60s. There was no recovery movement then, you know,
right.
And we couldn't, you know, we couldn't control the situation. And, you know, matters got worse. So when I got in high school, you know,
mm-hmm.
to escape from that, I did a lot of extracurricular activities in school, you know, because the home life, you know, I mean, my mom, she'd get maybe a couple weeks over here or there, but there was never any consistency, and we didn't know what to expect during the day. And, you know, it was just a very painful existence, but, you know, we tried to make the best of it. And so I remember getting a part for a play called West Side Story, and I was just really, really happy to be involved in it. But my first taste of drugs came when we were at rehearsal one time, and one of the actors, you know, pulled out a joint. At first, you know, I was scared, but I just want to feel like I belonged. You know what I mean? Call it peer pressure, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I think it was just a pressure of me, you know, just wanting to be part of, I guess. So anyway, you know, I smoked this joint, about three or four. Next thing I know, I'm high as a kite. You know, and I can remember from that day forward, you know, it was like I had just crossed the line of addiction then. Reason being is because all of the pent-up feelings I had inside that was going on at home and in our lives, you know.
Right.
When that marijuana just took all of that away, and, you know, it just gave me a feeling of relief, really, like, oh, my God, wow, gee, you know, I'm feeling pretty good. All these negative feelings are gone. So obviously, you know, then that turns into an addiction. Start running away from home. I get busted for joyriding. Next thing I know, my parents and I were sitting in front of this probation officer. And my mom, she begins to cry, saying that I was adopted right there in front of, right then and there. I mean, the word adoption was never mentioned in our family. And even though I remember the time that she got me when I was 3 years old, nothing more was ever mentioned of that. And even when we asked questions, you know, they, oh, we're your parents. Yeah, you were born, you know, I mean. So anyway, they tell me I'm an adopted, you know, and that hits me like a ton of bricks. And also they say, too, if you join the Army, they'll drop the charges. And so I joined the Army at 17.
A quick fix to a long-term solution.
To a long-term solution, and I was not seeking no solution back then, trust me.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
I was just really, I mean, stunned, really, you know, and things were going so fast, and I felt, well, maybe going into the Army to get away from this stuff will help me out, you know, and, you know, so anyway, I go into the Army, and and they're doing more drugs in there than they're doing out on the streets. So that doesn't really help me. I mean, you're smart. I mean, everybody's
And especially during that time period that you were in, because you were in Vietnam, am I correct?
Yeah, it was during the Vietnam era. People were coming back from Vietnam, and some were being stationed over in Germany, you know. But anyway, so I soldiered on, but what happened in the Army, memories would start surfacing. I didn't know anything about being abused, sexually abused, or anything like that. What was going on at that time is I was getting a lot of flashbacks, a lot of intrusive memories, and you know, it really scared me. And at the same time, these memories are coming. It seemed like, you know, my sexuality was becoming confused as well, because right up until that time, before these memories started to surface, I always thought I was heterosexual. I mean, I had a girlfriend. I never, you know, no, I'm not, you know, saying, I'm using this as an excuse because I'm this. Mm-hmm. I'm just telling you how I felt then and what these memories caused, which I didn't understand, together with feeling sexually confused, I was, you know, I kept it to myself, right? I certainly wasn't going to tell anybody in the Army. And so I said, well, the first thing I'm going to do is, you know, I got me a girlfriend. I believe I got her pregnant just to have kids, thinking that would somehow, you know, sort me out. This is my thinking. You know, but all the while, you know, I'm not telling anybody these things. I'm just kind of keeping it to myself, still using drugs. But I get out the Army, I get an honorable discharge. I get a job at...
and I just want to stop you right there. I want you
I'm
to...
I'm sorry, because I can keep talking. You better stop me and ask
me
questions.
No. But I just want to emphasize, I want to emphasize the point. You were honorably discharged. I just want to make that clear. You were honorably discharged.
Yes, I was honorably discharged. Yes, absolutely.
I want to make sure my audience understands that you were honorably discharged from the military, because that's going to be important to your story. And I want to make it clear that, you know, I want the world to know you were honorably discharged. So I'm sorry,
It was is that when my parents signed for me, you know, they had to tell the Army recruiter that, you know, well, they pulled out my green card and, you know, my German adoption papers. So the question was raised with my recruiter saying, well, how is it going to work out with the citizenship? And our recruiter said that I would automatically become a citizen once I got honorably discharged. So I went into service holding on to that promise. But that wasn't the case. What I was supposed to do, or what they were supposed to do, is have me to apply for citizenship while I'm in the Army. The recruiter just lied and said I'd automatically become one just so I could get on his rolls, but that wasn't the case.
Right.
And then, too, the Army knew that I wasn't a citizen because right before they sent me over to Germany on tour, they said, well, we realize you're not a citizen, and we're afraid if we send you to Germany that the German Army could draft you. I mean, it was crazy. So they sent me to Berlin instead. The bottom line is they knew. So I get out, I'm honorably discharged. I get a job at the Naval Shipyard under the Veterans Readjustment Appointment as an honorably discharged veteran. I work there. I get promoted to ship's painter. And then I get a memo from the personnel office saying, please come in. You have to show proof of your citizenship. So I go in there the next day with my DD-214, which is my honorable discharge. I show this to the personnel lady, and she looks at me and says, well, this is not a citizenship. And the bottom line, they terminated me 2 weeks later and told me, when I went to get my last check, they said, you have to wait outside the gate. You can no longer come in here because you're not a citizen, and we'll bring your check to you. And I think that was a point in my life where I said the F word, not only to them, but just to everybody. You know, I said, you know, to me, I think that was the ultimate, because it's like you took away my country. You took away, I already feel adopted anyway, the country that I was born in Germany. You know, the United States military didn't take responsibility for all of those fathers that left those children over there, or didn't take responsibility for us. I'm just saying, you know, we were kids. We weren't asked to be born. But the military has a lot to play in all of this. So I'm terminated, and I'm not a citizen. I don't even want to go be a citizen, you know. I just give up my spirit and just start using, you know, drugs and, you know, doing... working from pillar to post. But while I was working from pillar to post, I got really clever with computers. You know, they were coming into fashion back then. So, you know, I worked my way up to being a legal secretary, you know, making $40,000-$45,000 a year. But what I do, I get those jobs, but I would use the jobs to try to fix the pain inside. But once the novelty wore off, I would go back to using. Wound up on Skid Row. I was on crack for 20 years. Thankfully, my wife divorced me. Then I went to Skid Row, and I was just totally comatose, just walking around inside of mental hospitals, stealing out of stores to get a hit of crack, and there were like hundreds of us down there at that particular time between Skid Row and MacArthur Park. Back and forth, back and forth. I mean, it was like the ladders of living hell. And then, you know, going in jail was really a lifesaver for me. It really saved my life going to jail because I was so self-destructive on the outside. And by then, you know, I was hating myself. I still, you know, and I hated myself too because I knew by then I was bisexual. And I started prostituting on the streets. I don't know if I was prostituting to just kind of find out really if, is that what I was about, or was I doing it, you know, for the money or just, you know, to reach out. I don't know.
Right. Well, you were hurt.
I was not feeling pretty well.
Right.
So
right.
What happened is, I'm going to make a long story short. My last night spent in Los Angeles, I was on Skid Row. They had done a major drug sweep, and I was waiting for the dope man to come, and I fell asleep with my hand clutched on my 20 that I had in the pocket. Anyway, I wake up, police are on me like bees, right? And I can remember the police saying, you know, tonight we're going to save your life, you know, because I had absconded from parole. So anyway, I do my bit at Chino, and then the deportation people come. I couldn't believe it. You know, they're wearing brown uniforms. Mm-hmm. Things have changed, you know, now it's Homeland Security, Bush is the war starting. I mean, just everything is happening all at once. That makes me all the more, you know, looked upon as an alien because everybody was getting booted out then and, you know, patriotism, you know, it was just cuckoo. I want to burn the damn flag, really. I mean, the way I was feeling.
Right.
So the bottom line is, you know, they deported me after living in the States for 45 years. Can you imagine that?
Wow. I can't.
And then when I get to Germany, they didn't want to give me my citizenship for 9 months. I had to fight them because they said that they had to prove that my mother didn't get married again or something. And my mother was dead.
Oh, wow. Right.
You know, so I had a nervous breakdown, too. You know, I was like, done. So where am I at today? Well, when I came to London, I was still homeless, and I don't know. I said, you know what, I'm going to really, really do my best to get clean. And so I called the 12-step number, and I got into this 12-step, started going to 12-step meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And I was determined I was going to turn my life around. And I think I was in about 30 days clean and sober. I had a spiritual experience, like an out-of-body experience. It was like God just rolled a piece of heaven back, and I got to look at it. But because of that experience, it touched me in such a way that I felt that God has expressed himself in a way to me, and he's expressed his loves, and he knows all the stuff that I've been through. He doesn't care whether I'm gay, sexual, this or that, or what I've been through. What that experience did for me is like God touched me in a way where, like, I didn't have to believe in him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I know that he's real because I've seen it. I felt it. And because of that, you know, that's when I turned my life around and started an organization called Streetlights. We feed the homeless here in London. And
wow. Could you say the name of your organization?
Still a journey. It's called Streetlights. It's spelled Streetlights.
Okay. And can we find
yes, you can find it on the website. It's www.streetlights.org.
Wonderful. So I would encourage everyone.
Sorry if I'm talking so wordy and stuff, but
do not apologize. You are sharing your story, and that's wonderful for me. I want to get out your story. I think it's a wonderful story of rebirth and transformation, and that's what we're here about at Get Deep and Keep It Real, all about telling the truth, getting down to whatever your truth may be, and just being positive and trying to hopefully share a story that will help someone else, encourage someone else.
Absolutely.
And that's when I met you. I knew that I would love to be able to share your story, because I thought it was just such a wonderful, wonderful story of, you know, transformation. And I really, really appreciate you as a person and admire you. You know, that's a lot and there are many people who have been through less and have not survived. And so, you know, I really take my hat off to you as a veteran myself. You know, I really respect the fact that, you know, the military did not, and the U.S. has not done right by you, but you still managed to continue to serve our country in a positive manner in a different country.
Yes. Absolutely.
And so,
you know, and
I really wanted to, you know, say that to you. But getting back to your organization.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Could you go ahead and tell us more about your organization?
Oh, yes, about Streetlights. Yes, what we do
is
we partner with churches, and what we do is we get together and we create a drop-in center. In other words, the churches will let us use their hall, and we cook the food, provide the food, and then we invite the homeless and we eat with them. And as we're eating with them, we have peer mentors and volunteers on board, you know, to see, you know, whether they need immediate housing, are they looking for a detox. You know, we try to provide a pathway out from the streets, firstly by meeting their immediate needs, which is always food and clothing. Secondly, housing. And so we engage about 800 homeless per month at our two drop-ins. One is located in Shepherd's Bush, and the other one is located in Victoria. And, you know, Streetlights remind me
and
so much of myself.
I don't mean to interrupt you again.
No, go ahead.
Right. I just wanted to make it clear to the listeners that you're talking about in London. You're currently located in London. Because you've been, you know, deported. And so this organization is located in London and helping the homeless in London.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you know, and so we have the two drop-in centers in London. And, you know, I'm also an advocate for the homeless. There's a new law. They want to try to criminalize homeless people for sleeping out on the streets. So, you know, engaging the homeless, you know, you really have to engage them from different levels, even from a political one, because the issues of homelessness is always usually the last rung on the ladder. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of funding. So, you know, we have to fight for that and fight for their rights as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is just wonderful. I mean, so not only are you advocating for deported veterans, also, you know, helping homeless people and, you know, still trying to continue your own personal journey of transformation through serving others. And I think that's awesome. I really do. Now, I would like to ask you, do you happen to know how many other veterans are in your same situation?
It's in the thousands. I'd say around 10,000, something like that.
Right.
Thousands are getting deported every year, every day.
And that's
thousands
still a current situation.
Right. Now, I'm just talking about veterans.
Right.
I mean, the number's much higher, you know, for people that aren't veterans as well, so.
Right, exactly. But no, speaking of veterans, I think what I was trying to emphasize is that even today, we still have veterans who are being deported to this very day.
Absolutely.
Is that correct?
Yes,
right,
we
okay.
do. You know, and when they're deported, there's nothing on the other side to help them. You know, the country that they're deported to, you know, doesn't have them on their morning agenda expecting them. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so they have
exactly.
to, you know, scrape and crawl through the system and, you know, pull themselves up by the bootstraps. This is really hard when you're deported, you know.
So has there been any type of people to help advocate for you, to protest, any type of support for those of you who have been deported?
Not really, but thankfully I was contacted by Hector Barajas of Banished mm-hmm. Veterans in Tijuana. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was able to meet up with them this past summer. That's where I met you. And,
correct.
But they were, you know, I like what they're doing. And
right.
I think there's a couple more organizations out there. But to be honest, I really don't have any faith in terms of the United States ever changing their law to bring us back.
Right.
I truly believe that's not going to happen. It hurts me to my heart. And I
yeah.
think for me, you know, to work out my own salvation in terms of,
yeah.
you know, giving back keeps me in check psychologically,
yeah.
emotionally. Yeah, there's those periods, you know, where, you know, I'm crying and, you know, obviously, you know, wanting to go back to the United States, but I also have to accept responsibility. It was my fault. You know, had I not
right.
got arrested, you know, I wouldn't have got deported. So I accept
right.
responsibility, but what I don't accept responsibility for are the lies that the recruiter told me and my parents as a minor, promising me that
right.
I would automatically become a citizen once honorably discharged. That, I think, they owe me an apology for.
Definitely, definitely.
You know.
It's a very sad situation, but not only sad, it really makes me angry because they ask you, you volunteered, you know, to give your blood, sweat, and tears to a country that, you know, wasn't really yours, but you did it anyway. And, you know, you swore allegiance to this country. You did your time honorably. You didn't get kicked out or anything like that. You kept your promise. And so I just really feel hurt and disgusted and disappointed with my country because they have not kept their promise to you and so many other deported veterans who were honorably discharged and kept their promise and were lied to.
Yeah, it's a bummer.
So in these last 2 minutes of the show, I would like to give you, first of all, I would like to know, so what's on the horizon for you? I mean, I see so many wonderful things happening for you outside of that situation. And so where do you
yes.
see yourself in the next 5 to 10 years? What's your goal? What's your vision?
Well, my vision is I want to complete my book, and I want to, you know, continue being an advocate for the homeless. I'd like to set up a couple drop-in centers in Mexico and also in Africa. And just like, you know, just to be an inspiration to people that are still struggling with their addictions or think, you know, and struggling in life, that, you know, we can achieve, you know, our dreams and our goals. Yes, I've had setbacks and I've, you know, gotten angry, cursed God out the whole nine. But you know what? The bottom line is, you know, I get back up. I get back up, and I say,
yeah.
God, it's me and you. Let's do this. Let's
right.
take it to the hoop.
Right.
So everything I do, you know, I want to take it to the hoop. I don't want to do nothing
right.
half measures anymore, you know. You know, and I thank God from where I'm at, and I thank God for meeting people like you, and thank you for doing what you're doing, and you know, allowing us to share our stories and our pains and our struggles. And, you know, thank you for that. Touch
no
my
problem,
heart.
No problem. I think that sometimes the universe puts us all in certain situations, you know, so that we can have that contact with others to help to bring about some form of transformation and love and just a shared experience to let us all know that we're not alone in our struggles, even though they may be different struggles, but just to know that, you know, maybe someone has been through maybe something similar, but you can, you, like you said, if you fall down, you can still get back up no matter what,
Absolutely.
And so on that note, I would like to end the show, but I want you to give another plug for your, the name of your book and your organization.
Say that again, I'm sorry.
I said I would like for you to give another plug for your book and your organization before we wrap it up.
Oh, yes. The name of the book is called The World According to My Gospel, and should be coming out in a couple months. And please have a look at our organization on our website. Again, it's www.streetlights, spelled streetlights.org.
Wonderful. Thank you
Cheers.
So much for staying up late and hanging in with me, Mr. Rudy Richardson. Have a wonderful, blessed existence. And I love you.
I love you, too. Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Get Deep and Keep It Real with Tiffany Camella. I hope you have enjoyed my show today. If you have any questions or comments, please hit me up on Facebook or on Twitter. We are on Facebook and Twitter. That's Get Deep and Keep It Real at Facebook.com and on Twitter. Have a lovely evening. Good night.